Hello and welcome to Power Pros Podcast, episode 127. I'm your host, The Hoff, Chris Hoffman, and with me is my co-host and nemesis, Pete Michaud.
Hola, senor.
Howdy, Pete. I suppose it's good to have you back on the show.
It's good to be here.
We are back, of course, once again to talk about what's going on in the world of Nintendo. We've got new games to talk about and news to discuss, and we've also got this week's big topic, which is what if, as in what if, you know, things had played out differently in Nintendo's history.
Mm-hmm.
However, before we get to that, let's start off by talking about some of the new titles on Switch, starting with Bayonetta 2.
Sweet.
Now, I have to admit, I had never really played much Bayonetta before playing Bayonetta 2 on Switch. I got the game on PlayStation 3, the original one, and I never played it like past the first level. And then I got Bayonetta 2 on the Wii U, and I never played that beyond like the demo. So I'm pretty much a newbie to Bayonetta for all intents and purposes.
Yeah, me too.
Or for all intents and purposes. What about you? Have you played Bayonetta much?
I have not. I'm kind of a newbie when it comes to Bayonetta as well. I've been intrigued by the title, but I think that it's escaped me for whatever reason. I just, you know, didn't play my Wii U a ton, and I feel bad for admitting that. But, I'm actually really anxious to try it on Switch.
So did you pick it up?
I haven't yet, but I will.
Okay.
There's just too many games right now.
Well, let me tell you, coming at this as a brand new player from a fresh perspective, this game is, in a word, completely insane. I guess that's two words. But it's insane. It is absolutely over-the-top crazy. Like, just jumping in from the beginning, you're doing all kinds of insane stuff. You're fighting on top of a jet, and then on top of a moving train.
Right.
Then you're flying around in midair against some giant monster that you summoned, and apparently it turned against you. Then later on, you're like running up walls and going underwater, and some dude turns into a rodent. And then you're like surfing in a giant tidal wave, and you get eaten by a monster, and you're hopping between dimensions. So it's just totally off the chain, absolutely nuts.
That sounds like when I ask my niece what she did for, you know, at school today.
So your niece is Bayonetta?
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. It just sounds like a similar thing. It's like, yeah, and then this happened, and then, yeah.
Well, I hope she doesn't walk around with guns strapped to her feet. The gameplay, of course, is over-the-top crazy as well. You're just doing all kinds of dodging and flipping and jumping and shooting and punching and kicking and, you know, summoning these giant demon fists from another dimension. And it's just basically this endless array of combos and special attacks. Although it is broken up by other stuff. You do get to have sequences where you're just doing some exploring.
Sure.
Or, you know, a crazy scene like I was talking about before where you're, like, you know, surfing inside a giant tidal wave and dodging buildings that are coming towards you. Oh, and I forgot to mention, you can transform into a giant water snake and into a wolf or something, apparently. It's just like, you know, whatever crazy thing they could think of, they threw into this game, apparently.
Nice. And so, but the bottom line, I have to ask, is it fun?
Oh, it's definitely fun. It is, you know, fun and action-packed, and I really regret not playing this series until now. It's like, boy, I've really been missing out. I really should have played this game on Wii U, because it is an awful lot of fun.
Huh. Yeah, plus the main character is Sarah Palin.
Well, I'm not going to go there, but I will tell you one thing about the characters in the story, and that is that they're just as crazy as everything else. You know, since I haven't played Bayonetta 1, I'm jumping into Bayonetta 2, and it's like, what the heck is going on? Who are these characters? You know, there's something about witches and sages, and I'm not sure which ones are good and which ones are bad and who's your ally and who's not. I do know that there are lots of gratuitous crotch shots, and you know, there's almost nudity where they have like conveniently placed objects in front of naughty bits so the game doesn't get a rating that's higher than an M.
Are you getting flustered there, Hoffman?
Yes.
Huh.
There's also, you know, lots of swearing in there as well. So the game is M-rated. It definitely earns that M rating.
That's so funny. And plus, it's, you know, it's so interesting that Nintendo specifically sort of, you know, catered to this franchise, right? They, like,
yeah,
went out of their way to sort of fund it and you know, bring it to their system. So
yes.
Kind of cool. Plus, with the third one coming, it's, you know, they've doubled down, basically.
Yeah, they really, really have. And I can absolutely see why. I mean, it might seem weird, you know, having this M-rated game published by Nintendo that they did fund, but it makes a lot of sense because they don't really have a lot of games of this type in their library. So it really fills a big niche that nothing else does, so I can absolutely see why they'd want it. Switch may not have Devil May Cry or God of War, but it does have this. And if you're a fan of action games, it's a good one to pick up, I would say.
Huh, cool. You're really selling it and making a case for it.
Yeah, I'm really enjoying it. And, you know, there's lots of extra stuff in there as well, aside from the action. You know, there's, like, bonus challenge areas where you can earn extra power-ups. You know, you can explore off the beaten path to, you know, find items that increase your health or your magic. You acquire rings to buy weapons and accessories. There's even an online co-op mode that I haven't tried yet. And it has amiibo functionality.
Amiibo!
If you use specific amiibo, you can unlock new outfits. I used one of the Bayonetta Smash Brothers amiibo, and that got me a whole bunch of alternate costumes, as well as outfits based on various Nintendo characters. You can also use the Peach, Daisy, Link, Samus, and Fox amiibo to unlock outfits corresponding to those characters.
Now, if only you had some of those amiibos to try.
right. Yeah, obviously I did try them all out immediately. I think you can acquire all that stuff through other means, but it just saved me a whole bunch of in-game currency. I was able to get them right away, and suddenly I'm dressed up as Sexy Daisy, which, you know, I'm sure is in a lot of people's fanfics.
Man, I've never wanted to ever hear you say Sexy Daisy.
The cool thing about playing in the Daisy or Peach outfit is that instead of the rings the enemies drop, they drop coins instead. It even makes, you know, like the Mario coin sound
That's
effect.
That's cool.
And the demon that they summon in their combo attacks is actually Bowser.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay,
so,
that's pretty sweet.
Like I said, it's just completely insane. It's nuts.
Sounds like your kind of game.
Yeah, I like it. I like it a lot. I did get the physical edition, which means I got Bayonetta 2 on a game card, and then Bayonetta 1 is a download, but I haven't actually had a chance to play Bayonetta 1 yet, mostly because the code I got in my box was a bum code.
Wow, that's kind of crazy.
Yeah, I don't know if you noticed, but Nintendo actually went on social media and they're like, oh, hey, some of the codes we sent out aren't any good, so, you know, contact customer service if it's a problem.
Yikes.
And that is what happened to me. My code just didn't work, so I had to call them up. And, you know, they sent me a replacement via email within, like, 24 hours.
Oh, cool.
Still threw me off enough that I wasn't able to, you know, download the game and spend any time with it. But, you know, I'm glad that they got me working code. I'm glad I will be able to try it out.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm, like, in Chapter 9 in Bayonetta 2, so I think I'm making pretty good progress. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this one, obviously, it's not sitting on my shelf like the Wii U version did. This one I am really playing through, and hopefully I'll be able to finish it off shortly and then play through Bayonetta 1 as well.
Cool. Now, do you know what the, not to put you on the spot here, but do you know what the prices are for the physical version versus digital in this case?
Oh, it's a very weird thing. You know,
yeah.
It's a $60 game if you buy it in the store, but if you buy the games separately on the eShop, I think it's $50 for Bayonetta 2 and $30 for Bayonetta 1, but only if you buy them individually. If you then buy the other one, you get a corresponding discount. So it ends up being $60
either way. Wow.
Yeah.
That's so weird. I read something like that, but then like they didn't actually say what the price was, so I was very confused.
Well, it's very confusing, so I understand.
Yeah. Now, at least it's not like a rebate in hindsight. Like, I always hate that because you never know.
Right.
You have to like watch your bank account and becomes a mini game.
Nope, it's nothing like that. It's kind of like the weird pricing they did for Star Fox Zero and you know, Uncle Grippy's, you know, special robot fighting quest or whatever it was called.
You're Uncle Grippy.
I am not. If I was, I'd take you out to the woodshed.
I don't even know what that means.
Anyway, like I said, I'm digging the game. I like it quite a bit. It's a whole lot of fun. If you play M-rated action games, totally check it out.
Well, I play M-rated action games. You know, actually, the you know, now that you've told me the pricing, I actually think that it makes sense for me to maybe download the first one to try it out. If I like it, then I'll invest and spend the rest of the money on Bayonetta 2.
Yeah, that could be one way to do it, too. Mm-hmm.
Cool.
But since you haven't been playing Bayonetta 2, Pete, what have you been playing in the meantime?
Oh, well, I'm glad you asked. I know I've mentioned this before that I played the demo, but I went ahead and bought Dragon Quest Builders.
Oh, all right.
Yeah, it's I'm enjoying it quite a bit. Although I will say that the parts that I've played so far are really just a repeat of the demo.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah, this is one of those exceptions where they don't let you just jump from your demo into the main game, even though from everything I could see so far, it is an exact replica of the demo.
Mm-hmm.
So they're asking me to do all the same things all over again. And, you know, if you haven't played the demo, it is a pretty sizable endeavor. It's about...
yeah, it's like 2 hours or something.
Yeah, at least 2 hours, I'd say. And that's if you're not poking around. I mean, you can actually do quite a bit, like as far as, you know, go exploring and stuff. There's not much you can do outside of the main quest, but still, they give you kind of a lot of room to just kind of do what you want. There's no time limit, per se.
Right.
That being said, you know, the game is awesome, in my opinion. You know, I've always liked Minecraft from a concept point of view, but for me to actually play Minecraft is almost kind of like, I don't know. At this stage of my life, it's hard to play a game that's just open-ended and there's no, like, you know, clear goals in mind besides, you know, just sort of surviving. I think that the concept of Minecraft kind of, like, makes my head hurt a little bit, just the fact that, like, well, okay, it's Legos. But I just, you know, it's been so daunting that it really doesn't make me want to play it.
And this game has more of a better focus, you're saying, huh?
Yes, I think Dragon Quest Builders really kind of gives you a lot more structure. It gives you sort of that, like, I don't know. It gives you a lot of, like, here, go try this. Or here, you know, go find this thing that'll help you build other stuff. So there's a lot more, you know, structure, hand-holding, scaffolding, whatever you want to call it.
Mm-hmm.
I just think that already what I've played in it makes me happy, and it gives me that sort of, like, gamification that I need in a lot of games where I'm not just, you know, aimlessly walking trying to figure out what I'm going to do next.
Okay, that makes sense. Now, playing through it sort of a second time, did you discover anything new or learn anything different or were you able to apply things that you learned from the demo to the main game?
You know, that's a good question. I know there are a couple things where I just, you know, knew what I was doing so I could go a lot quicker. That being said, there's still a lot of stuff that's like time-based and, you know, you have day-night cycles, so you kind of are stuck on what you can do in one day. You know, it's not boring to play through it again. It's just tedious, and I'm just anxious to see what happens. The end of the demo ends on a cliffhanger.
Right, as you're heading off to that new world.
Yeah, and I really want to see what happens beyond that, so that's kind of my motivation at the moment.
Okay, cool. Well, I'll be interested in hearing your further thoughts as you proceed further along in that title.
Yeah, thanks. I would say that if you're interested in buying that game and you're on the fence, it is a really solid game, so I would say forego the demo and just buy it. Now, if you need some convincing, maybe the demo is worth playing. But it is about 2 to 3 hours of gameplay you might just end up redoing if you end up making the purchase.
Yeah, just kind of a two-edged sword. I mean, I never would have been really interested in the game if I hadn't played the demo. But now I know if I pick up the full game, I'll have to replay those 2 hours. You know, there's worse things in the world than playing through a pretty fun video game. So
yeah, what I really like about it too is the there's enough Dragon Quest stuff in it that, like, it kind of adds some charm. Like, they've got the little, you know, little like level up sounds and the you found something sounds and the, I don't know, just the, if you're a fan of the Dragon Quest series in general, there's a lot of nods and it kind of makes you you know, gives you some nostalgia for the series. So.
Yeah, totally. You know, some of the items, some of the enemies, and of course the character designs as well.
Oh, yeah.
All very Dragon Questy.
Very, very Dragon Questy, but also very Minecraft. So if you've always kind of wanted to play Minecraft, but you don't like that open endedness, it's a worthy successor, I guess.
All right, good to know.
Yeah.
The other game that I, you know, just started playing again is Super Mario Odyssey, because the new update to that game has finally arrived.
Yeah.
By that, of course, I mean the new Luigi Balloon Hunt minigame.
Oh, yeah, I've heard this launched. So what do you think?
It's not bad. It's not bad at all. It's pretty fun, it adds new life to the game, and it allows for some thoughtful creativity.
Hmm.
You know, it's very, very simple. You just, you know, talk to Luigi in any level, and then you can choose, do you want to hide a balloon, or do you want to, you know, hunt down other people's balloons. You can only do one balloon hiding per game level. You know, if you want to hide a second time, the first one goes away. But yeah, it's very simple and straightforward in that regard. You have about, you know, 30 seconds to get to whatever location you want to get to, and then you plant your balloon there. Or on the flip side, you just choose from a list of balloons to track down, and you know, then you just go out and do it, and you try to get it within the time limit. Like I said, you know, there are people, you know, putting in places I wouldn't have really expected. Yeah, I've only played around with this a little bit, and I've just done some of this mode in the Cascade Kingdom. And one of the things that I saw somebody had done was, you know, they quickly ran over to the Tyrannosaurus Rex, they took over the T-Rex, they smashed some rocks, and then they, in that spot where the rocks were smashed, they hit a balloon there. And so then, you know, to find that balloon, you have to do the same thing. You have to smash those rocks. Otherwise, the balloon is hidden out of view. So, you know, putting balloons in places that you can't reach just by running to them, you know, is pretty cool. And it makes things a lot more interesting because there is an arrow, there is an indicator on screen about how far the balloon is. So if you just follow the indicator and chase after the balloon, it's like, okay, well, you know, that's pretty darn simple. But if you add a little puzzle element to it, then it becomes a lot more interesting. So I'm glad to see that people are already getting innovative. I'm kind of dreading encountering a balloon that someone hid by making a crazy series of precision long jumps or something like that, but it hasn't happened yet.
Right.
Then again, I've only played 7 or 8 balloon hunts so far.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like an interesting concept. I like the idea, and it's like such a novelty thing. But yeah, it sounds like a good way to add like more replayability to Super Mario Odyssey.
Oh yeah, totally. And the other thing about it is that it's a great way to get coins. Now, it does cost you a few coins to participate in this game if you're trying to, you know, hunt down these balloons. It's usually something small, like 10 coins, although I've seen some of them being like 80 coins. But your reward is usually like in, you know, 50 coins or 100 coins or 200 coins, so your return can be much greater than what you spend, but there is, you know, sort of this gambling element to it. If you have a lot of coins, it's not a problem, but the last time I played the game was like when I spent, you know, 9,999 coins on one of the hard-to-get outfits, so my bank account for Mario was completely depleted. I had to run around and gather a few coins. But then, you know, it wasn't long before I, you know, found a few balloons, and suddenly I had a couple more 100 coins in the vault. So, you know, that was a nice way to do it. And that's good, because there are now new outfits available as part of this update.
Oh, yeah?
There is the musician hat and suit.
Yep.
For 500 and 1,000 coins, respectively.
Wow.
The sunshine shades and outfit for 1,500 and 3,000 coins, respectively. And then a knight helmet and knight armor for 3,000 and 5,000 coins. So you're going to need quite a bit of coins to get all of these new outfits.
Nice.
I will, of course, be getting them all in due order. I haven't mean to go back to that game. There's still some worlds where I haven't, you know, hunted down everything. So this is a cool, fun, convenient excuse to do so.
That's cool. I was just reading online about that Luigi will react to what Mario dresses as.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he does. You know, the first time I approached him, I was dressed as a skeleton. And Luigi goes like, hey, bro, that outfit's kind of, you know, I don't want to say nothing, but yeah. And then after that, I went back to my ship and I dressed up as Luigi. And went out there, and he's like, whoa, it's another me.
Amazing.
It's kind of funny that when Luigi talks, he doesn't have any of his, you know, mannerisms that, you know, you associate with him when he's just doing his babble and stuff.
That's
but
funny.
I guess that's the way he's talked in other games, like the Paper Mario series, when he just shows up as sort of a side character. So I guess it kind of makes sense.
That's true.
Anyway, it's a fun little addition. It's totally free, other than, you know, the coin cost in-game. But, yeah, absolutely no reason not to try it out and give it a spin.
Yeah, that's cool. It almost makes me wish that, like, somehow they could do that with, like, Mario 64 or something. It's like it's always nice to have, like, some reason to keep you going back to a game.
Yep, absolutely. And, you know, this is a good one. It's a good reason to do it.
Cool. I'll have to check it out.
And speaking of Super Mario, let's transition over to some news. So, the folks over at comic book publisher Dark Horse have announced that, indeed, the Super Mario Encyclopedia is coming out in North America.
Oh, nice.
This was rumored quite some time ago. I think we talked about it on the show like 6 months, maybe even a year ago. But, you know, then nothing really happened. But, hooray, it is now official. It's supposed to be coming out this October at a price of $40. 256 pages of Mario goodness.
Nice. Are you going to pick this one up?
Oh, yeah, I definitely am. And in fact, You know, I picked up the Japanese version of this, and it is very much what it says. It is a complete encyclopedia that tells you everything about Mario's platforming adventures, you know, from the original Super Mario Brothers all the way up through, you know, every game on, you know, GameCube, Wii, Wii U, 3DS, you name it. It covers his, all the characters in the game, his enemies, power-ups, obstacles, levels. It's all there, and it's got pictures for everything and a little description. This is not an art book. I mean, it does have art for everything, but that's not the focus of the book. You know, a lot of the things are shown, you know, very small, but it is packed full of information. So I got the Japanese one, and, you know, there's all this information, but I can't read it because it's in Japanese.
Right.
So, yeah, I am very happy that it's finally coming out in North America. I actually read all the stuff that I was looking at in the Japanese version.
You really are a super fan, Chris.
Why, thank you. This is why I have no money.
Mm-hmm.
However, on the downside, this is a book that came out 3 years ago in Japan, and still, on the cover of this, you'll see that it says, you know, 30th anniversary, 1985 to 2015, so that means it does not have Super Mario Odyssey in there. So in that regard, it's going to feel a little bit dated. It appears they are not adding a new section, a new chapter, or new content to reflect that. So you're going to pick this book up and you're going to say, how come the date on here says 3 years ago? Why is there no Odyssey? Why is there no Mario Maker?
Right.
But yeah, that's the unfortunate part about this book.
It also feels like anything you're going to try and release for Mario is eventually going to be outdated anyway.
Well, sure, but you'd still expect it to have the latest releases.
but no, it's cool. I mean, I think just from the sounds of it, I haven't seen the Japanese version at all, but sounds like you know, if you're into Mario, this is kind of your go-to coffee table book.
Yeah, it's very, very extensive from what I can gather. Also, even though it doesn't really cover the Mario games outside of the platformers, there is a section at the back that does make mention of like every single game that Mario has been in. You know, the Mario Karts and, you know, all the games he had cameos in and all that sort of thing. You know, it's not a lot. It's just, you know, one section, just a few pages long at the back. But yeah, it does have a lot of extra stuff in there, you know, to fuel your need for all things Mario.
It's cool.
Yeah, it's available for pre-order now. It's up there on Amazon. Like I said, the MSRP is $40, but the last time I checked, the Amazon price was only $24. So if you want to save some money, you can get a pre-order in now.
Well, Chris, now you know what I want for Christmas.
Right. Yeah, I'll let Santa know.
Thanks.
Moving along then to some other news items. Capcom has revealed some details about Mega Man Legacy Collection 1 and 2 for Switch.
Oh.
Most importantly, the game has a release date. Both games are being released on May 22nd.
Ah, and how does that make you feel?
It makes me feel mega great. Actually, it doesn't, and I'll explain why.
I was hoping it would make your beard tingle or your whiskers tingle.
No, that's you. That's you. But yes, we've got Mega Man Legacy Collection 1, which contains Mega Man 1 through 6. And then we've got Mega Man Legacy Collection 2, which contains Mega Man 7 through 10, along with all of the DLC that was released for the latter couple of games. Legacy Collection 1 also has the challenge stages that were in the 3DS version. Again, they'll be unlocked via amiibo, but hopefully it's not like the 3DS game where you had to use the amiibo every single time to unlock these stages every time you wanted to try them. That was kind of annoying, so cross my fingers for that. Mega Man Legacy Collection 2 will also have unlockable amiibo-based challenge stages, and again, I hope it's just one scan and then you get them permanently. That would be nice. But yeah, Legacy Collection 1, if you buy it digitally, it is only $15.
Wow.
That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, that's worth having.
And then Legacy Collection 2 is only $20.
Nice.
However, Capcom is also releasing a physical edition, sort of. It's got Mega Man Legacy Collection 1 and 2. It costs $40, and it comes with like some Mega Man bonus cleaning cloth or something like that.
Okay.
And, you know, of course, I'll have to get it for that. But
I don't know what you're going to be cleaning with that.
But on the downside, you only get Mega Man Legacy Collection 1 on the game card, and you still have to download Mega Man Legacy Collection 2.
Ah.
Which is kind of the same stunt they pulled with the Resident Evil games
yeah.
that were recently re-released on Switch.
But the difference is that Resident Evil is like massive amounts of bandwidth. And
yeah, exactly.
This game's like nothing.
So I guess I can see that, you know, in one of two ways. With Resident Evil, you could be like, boy, I really wish this had been on a game card so I wouldn't have to download so much. Or you could be like, well, why the heck is Capcom making me download this when they could easily squeeze, you know, all 10 games and all the extra content onto a single game card? You know, there's really no excuse for that.
Yeah.
You know, these aren't huge. It would be really easy to do. It just seems kind of dumb to me.
Yeah.
That's a bit of a letdown, but
I can see your point of view on that one, Chris.
Yeah, I would definitely be more excited if it was, you know, full physical, but, you know, I'll still be buying the physical card anyway and downloading the rest and getting my little cloth thing. But why can't you just go all the way, Capcom? Come on. What are you worried about?
So to rephrase, you would wish that Capcom would go all the way physical with you.
I suppose you could put it that way, yes.
Sorry, you don't have to run that. I just wanted to say it. So, Chris, I have a confession to make.
Yeah?
I went to download Zeo Drifter the other day because I've heard it's great. And it looks
really cool,
and it just came out, and it's only $10.
Yes, indeed.
So go pick it up. But then when I got to the eShop, I saw that Resident Evil Revelations 2 was only $12.
Yeah, okay.
And I couldn't help myself but to download that and go to sleep for the night. But I will be picking up Zeo Drifter soon. I know.
Uh-huh.
Jules Watson needs to eat, and and honestly, I you know, that game looks great, and I really want to play it. That being said, I was also like kind of floored that Revelations 2 was only $12.99, I believe.
Yeah, that's a lot of game for your money. It's probably one of the highest you know, bits per dollar that you can get.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. I think it's like maybe like I think it's like a 24 gig game, so that's like 2 gigs every dollar.
Oh wow.
Yeah.
What a bargain.
Anyway, good times. I haven't played it yet, but I'll let you know. Have you ever played that one?
No, I haven't. I think if it had come out on 3DS or maybe Wii U, I probably would have tried it. But no, since it's sort of a new release and it's only on Switch, I haven't had a chance yet.
Now, isn't Barry Burton in that one?
He is definitely in the Resident Evil Revelations titles, but at this moment I cannot remember if he's in Part 2 or only in the first one. At any rate, the series as a whole is full of fantastic beardiness, I'm pretty sure.
You know, Dragon Quest Builders has a great beard in it, too.
Yes. I imagine that's the main reason you bought it.
Nearly.
Well, moving on to another upcoming third-party game for the Switch. Sega has announced that Shining Resonance Refrain is going to be coming out this summer.
Shining Resonance Refrain.
Thanks for that, Pete. Now, apparently, this is an upgraded version of the original Shining Resonance, which came out several years ago on PlayStation 3. And I have to admit, I don't think I've ever even heard of it before.
Yeah, I've never heard of this game.
You know, I do try to follow the Shining series somewhat. I like the old Shining Force titles back in the day, and it's had some other excellent releases as well. But yeah, somehow I just totally missed that this one existed, and I guess the PS3 version never came out here. Anyway, this new one is coming out, and it's apparently an action RPG, you know, not a strategy game like the old Shining Force titles that the series is best known for. But yeah, it looks interesting from what they've shown so far. You know, the trailer mainly revealed a bunch of sword-wielding warriors and lots of dragons, and there really wasn't much in terms of gameplay as far as I could tell. But regardless of that, it's definitely cool to see this game coming stateside, and it's definitely cool to see it coming to Switch. I think it says a lot that Sega's decided to bring this game out, and, you know, part of their game plan is, yes, we're going to support it with a, you know, release on Switch alongside it coming out on other platforms. So that's pretty darn cool.
Yeah, everybody wants a game on Switch now.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it also reminds me that they've got the new Valkyria Chronicles game coming out on Switch sometime this year that I'm also looking forward to.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, I don't really know enough about Shining Resonance yet to know if it's going to be a game that I'm going to have to purchase, but it's just cool that it's happening at all.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm down.
Yeah, can't wait to find out more. Okay, that takes care of the news for this week. Let's take an intermission, and then when we come back, we'll discuss this week's big topic. What if? All right, we are back and we are ready to discuss this week's big topic, which is what if, as in what if Nintendo history had turned out differently than the way things actually occurred? What if Nintendo had made different choices? Or what if Nintendo's consumers had different interests and had made different choices? So we're going to talk about a handful of scenarios and discuss how things could have turned out differently for Nintendo.
I like this one, Chris. It's a good topic. When you mentioned it, I was like, oh yeah, there's a lot of ways we could go with this. So,
well, hopefully it turns out to be as interesting in practice as it sounds on paper.
I mean, all these, like, you know, alternate reality stories with Nintendo are kind of fun because they've been around for just so dang long.
Most of them. Yeah, that's true. But this first one I'm going to start with, you know, this isn't really, you know, a story from Nintendo's past so much as it was just something I'd been thinking about lately. And that is, what if Nintendo had transitioned straight from Wii into the Switch? You know, they didn't have the Wii U at all. What if, you know, the Switch, you know, had just been their next system? And, you know, in many ways, Switch is what Wii U, you know, should have been or could have been. You know, the main hook is the off-screen play, but, you know, it wasn't quite fully realized with Wii U because you could only take it a very small distance and you couldn't really, you know, take it on the go. But then with Switch, you know, it turned out to be something that everyone's really excited about. You could hook it to your TV or you could take it, you know, across the country with you.
Right.
So I'm proposing, you know, what would have happened if that had been Nintendo's idea, you know, right in 2012, and we didn't go through everything with Wii U?
Well, I think that's a hard one, Chris, because essentially in 2012, you kind of have to look at what technology was available and for the right price for them to be able to sell it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think if you did do something like that, you know, obviously the Switch would be vastly more underpowered than the Wii U, or it would end up costing more. So then, you know, it kind of puts Nintendo in a weird spot, right? It's like, would that version of the Switch end up being $500, or would it end up being, you know, inferior in, you know, most graphics to the Wii U that currently existed, right?
Yeah, I suppose that's one thing that that could have happened. We could have ended up with a, you know, technologically inferior system or an overpriced system.
It's a hard one to imagine. I think that part of the reason why the Switch is so good is because they did learn some things with the Wii U.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And that's where I was going to say as well, is that I'm not sure it would have really been possible to have the Switch come out and be successful without having failed with the Wii U first.
Yeah, that's an interesting thought.
I mean, and in addition to, you know, technology being totally different, I just think that Nintendo's mindset was totally different. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that when Wii U came out, you know, they were very, very much holding on to the success of Wii. You know, they were still thinking, you know, we've got this blue ocean, we've got this expanded audience, you know, Wii Fit, Wii Music, Nintendo Land. You know, this is what Nintendo was all about.
Right.
But at that time, you know, that audience had kind of moved on to smartphones and they didn't really care what Nintendo was really doing. I mean, the Wii U, you know, as a gamer, looking back at this thing, it had a lot of really cool stuff.
Right.
And I think that it could have been a huge success, but, you know, at the time, Nintendo's mind just, you know, wasn't in the right place in the game. You know, they were focusing more on the casual stuff and gamers didn't want that.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when Wii U started, you know, they were releasing stuff like Nintendo Land and Sing Party and Game & Wario.
Right.
And, you know, nobody cared. And it wasn't until Nintendo was like, oh, okay, the audience for these games aren't there anymore. It's only the core Nintendo fans who are still with us. And then they changed their mindset. And it wasn't until that happened that we were able to get games like, you know, Breath of the Wild.
Yeah.
Or Super Mario Odyssey. And Nintendo's, you know, focus was just in a very, very different place back then. So even if Nintendo did somehow have this magical technology that wasn't overpriced,
right,
and it had still come out back then, they could have, you know, the best hardware in the world, but, you know, if they were still heavily focusing on, like, you know, infants and grandpas, it really wouldn't have mattered. And so in my mind, it would have been like a great idea that, again, just fell on deaf ears.
Yeah.
So I kind of feel like they had to fail. They had to learn some hard lessons. And so then after Wii U didn't work out, they're like, okay, now we have a great idea, a great lineup that appeals to gamers and non-gamers, and we have the mindset to make this a big hit and make it succeed. And it was only through that combination of situations that allowed it to happen.
Yeah, I have to agree with you. I think that Nintendo, it's almost like a Nintendo with their back against the wall is the best version of Nintendo.
Yes, a lot of times that's true.
And it's potentially because they're just more willing to take risks, right? When you're on top and you've done really well, like with the Wii, mm-hmm. it's hard to go, okay, now we're going to risk everything and try something weird.
Right. They kind of want to hold on to that success.
Yeah. So I think that, you know, I can't blame them for the sort of the pitfall they fell into with the Wii U. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I think that you make a good point in the fact that Wii U really kind of helped them redefine what the Switch should be.
Yes.
And essentially, you know, a lot of things. You can look at, like, the UI, you know, the interface for the Switch. Mm-hmm. I love how snappy it is, right? It's almost like an iPad in a way. You can jump in and out of programs. And with the Wii U, it literally would take maybe 2 minutes to go from, you know, the Miiverse to, like, the shop channel.
Yeah, it totally took way too long. And I kind of feel like they kind of learned the wrong lesson from that, because I kind of think that they went too far the wrong way. I mean, you know, if it means we get a little bit of fun and a little bit of music, I can wait an extra, you know, 10 seconds or 5 seconds or something.
Well,
but yes, it's they definitely learned a lot and made it for the better.
We'll see what happens when they have the paid online service. There, you might start to see some more if that kind of flourishes. But
I hope so.
But yeah, and I think just in general, those kind of things. I also think another huge thing they learned was, you know, pacing of titles and. The Switch has gotten, you know, it's so good at, like, once a month having some piece of software you, like, absolutely must buy. So I think they've learned that. You know, Wii U really had some huge droughts, and I think that was part of its doom as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to think if there was another lesson, but I can't.
Well, I think probably, you know, just dealing with, you know, third parties and online, and, you know, they somehow have wound up in a situation now where every week we just have an abundance of third-party software available for download on the eShop.
Yeah.
And, you know, they learned a lot of that, you know, by going through what they did with Wii U. And there was still a lot of stuff on Wii U. You know, I don't think people were buying it as much because it was on Wii U.
Right.
But I kind of feel like they were able to hone and perfect that. And now we've got, you know, this just embarrassment of riches where it's like, oh my gosh, there's so much good stuff every week. That, you know, that's now, like, the biggest problem on the Switch is, like, just too much good stuff. We can't keep track of it all. So
yeah,
I think that is another thing they were able to hone through that experience.
Yeah, I mean, to my earlier point, I think that the thing is, you know, I do think there would have been a bigger disconnect with the quality of, like, a graphics if they did make a handheld back then. I think the thing that makes the Switch so compelling is that you don't really have to make a sacrifice to play your games portably, where I don't know if that would have been true had they transitioned straight to Switch.
Yeah, I remember talking about it back at the time and, you know, kind of, you know, thinking that they were going to make some, you know, console handheld hybrid, like, you know, 3 or 4 years ago.
Right.
And, you know, I would talk about that with friends and I'd be like, but boy, how do they do this? It just doesn't really seem feasible. Yet they proved it actually is. I guess it just took a little longer than you know, we were thinking.
Yeah, especially to, like, get it down to something like $300.
Yep, totally. All right. So sort of the flip side to this question is, how would things have been different if the Wii U actually had been a success?
Ah. Do you want to take this one or you want me to start again?
I guess I'll start this time.
Cool, let's do it.
I kind of feel like we still would have wound up with the Switch eventually. I mean, as we said before, it is kind of the natural progression of where things are going. But let's say people had bought into it. They liked the direction that Nintendo was going. They were totally into the gamepad. And I think that would have worked out well. It just would have meant, I think, very different software libraries and very different timing. I don't think we would have had Switch already. It would probably be coming up, you know, like later this year if, you know, they'd still been riding Wave of Success on Wii U.
Yeah.
I also think that we'd be getting more games, you know, like, you know, Brain Training or Nintendogs.
Right.
And we probably would not be getting a game like Breath of the Wild. We'd probably be getting the follow-up to Skyward Sword that had, you know, motion controls and, you know, wacky touch screen antics with the gamepad.
It's an interesting thought.
But as far as the transition to Nintendo's next system, I still think that we would have ended up at the same spot with the Switch.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that maybe, and this is just like a purely hypothetical because we're going that way. I almost think that, because when I first remember hearing about the Switch, I remember thinking, well, maybe the dock actually has some kind of beefy hardware in it that allows the console to be more powerful on television.
Mm-hmm.
And I almost wonder if Wii U had been more of a success, if something like that might have been more realistic, in the sense where you have a cool portable that's maybe as powerful as the Switch, but when you actually dock it, then you get something more like, you know, a PS4 or an Xbox One, maybe even the Pro version. Mm. And I know that seems so far-fetched and hard to imagine, but honestly, I think that's the only other thing that could really be missing. And if the Wii U had proven that proof of concept, I think that there could be an element of that in this current gen, but it's so hard to sell.
Well, I do think that, you know, it would have, you know, emboldened them. They would have said, like, oh yeah, people really like this concept. Let's find a way to make it even bigger and better. And then perhaps they would have thought, yeah, we can beef it up and, you know, maybe charge a little more for it to do something like that. So I see that as being a distinct possibility.
Hmm. Did we just agree on something?
I'm afraid we did.
Nice. I even gave you a compliment this episode, so we're on a roll here.
Okay, well, let's dig way back into the mid-90s and talk about another, you know, possible scenario that could have happened but didn't.
Hmm.
What if Nintendo had ended up partnering with Sony and creating, you know, the Nintendo PlayStation?
Now, do we have to talk like Bill and Ted since we're in the mid-90s, or...?
Only if you want to, dude.
Man, that would have been most triumphant.
Wasn't that in the 80s?
Yeah, I guess so. But it's close enough.
Bogus.
So what if Nintendo had partnered with Sony for the PlayStation? Man,
yeah.
Isn't that a bonkers question to ask at this point?
Kind of. I mean, it sounds completely outlandish, you know, knowing where Nintendo is now, where Sony is now.
Yeah.
But, you know, at one time, it was actually a thing that was supposed to happen until Nintendo decided, no, we don't want to do that. They jumped off the CD bandwagon.
Yeah.
And Sony went off and made their own thing. And, you know, obviously, to huge success.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, if they had partnered together, I actually think it would have gone well. I think they would have completely, you know, demolished the competition. I think Microsoft would have gotten into the game at some point regardless.
Oh, yeah, I agree 100%. I mean, the 90s would have been very different. You know, instead of having Sony's dominance, it would have been, you know, Nintendo PlayStation dominance. It would have been an unstoppable juggernaut.
Yeah.
You know, Nintendo still would have had all the brands and all the recognition that it had from previous generations. It still would have had all the third-party support, and it would have the hardware that you know, people ended up loving from PlayStation.
Yeah, it's like almost mind-blowing when you think about that.
So I think a lot of that stuff, you know, seems, you know, fairly obvious. But one thing that, you know, maybe you might not think about as much is what would happen to the competition.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I totally agree that Microsoft would have eventually gotten in on the act. But I also think that maybe Sega would have still been able to remain in the game a little bit longer,
you know,
because they weren't vying for, you know, third or fourth place.
Right.
You know, they could still, you know, be the scrappy underdog, and they could still be in the fight for everybody else's money. You know, we have Sony and Nintendo on one side, and then we have, you know, the little guy Sega here who could still have remained, you know, sort of the alternative, and they probably wouldn't have had a big piece of the pie necessarily, but, you know, Dreamcast would have lasted longer, or maybe they would have even had a system after that. And who knows, maybe some of the innovative titles that Sony got, you know, a Nintendo system wouldn't need. You know, they've already got mascot characters like Mario.
Right.
Do they need Crash Bandicoot and Spyro? Maybe Sega would have ended up with those.
Right. Or so, even like, you know, Uncharted or Shadow of the Colossus, some of those games that I know they didn't really have a lot to do with, but at the same time,
kind
of came to Sony's aid.
And so if they had a Nintendo PlayStation, they might not need some of these innovative titles, and they could have wound up with the competition. That could have, you know, really ended up strengthening Sega. However, to what you were saying, I think that probably eventually, you know, like what happens to, you know, pretty much all big companies, you know, they end up being awesome for a while, but then they'd sort of end up being, you know, arrogant, and they'd make rules people didn't like, and people would be grumpy, and, you know, the prices might be too high, you know, like Sony did with the PlayStation 3 for $600.
Yeah, absolutely.
So then I think Microsoft could come in, and who knows, maybe Microsoft would even end up, you know, purchasing Sega in this alternate reality.
Yeah,
and
I can see that.
And they could still end up coming in and upsetting everything with the 360 and, you know, putting in some really strong competition against the Nintendo PlayStation.
Yeah, it's it almost makes your head spin when you really think about the ramifications of what that could mean to the gaming industry and, you know, just to society as a whole. I know that sounds almost like a lot, but it's like when you really think about...
Well, the industry as a whole anyway.
Yeah, I think when you think about the way games, you know, impact people's lives and stuff, it's just kind of funny to imagine, you know, the ripple effect of such a thing. Mm-hmm. And it just, it's such like a piece of video game lore, video game history lore, that it's just, it's literally one of the most pivotal points in the entire history of the industry.
Yeah, totally. You know, I do think, though, that, you know, having competition is good. You know, having even Nintendo PlayStation going up against, you know, Sega, Microsoft would have created some really good competition, probably would have had really great games, and then probably Nintendo still would have responded, being like, oh, yeah, well, we've got motion control, and then they still would have made a system that ended up being like the Wii, but probably, you know, also crazy powerful. And so then we probably would have ended up in a place that's not too different from where we are now, but I think it just would have been a very different path to get there.
Yeah, it's true. I the thing I wonder about is like the handhelds, right? Like, would we have ever seen something like the DS? Like, the DS is such a Nintendo DS is such a strange device in general that you almost think Sony would have never been okay with something like that. So, you know, I guess,
but Nintendo was kind of the driver in this partnership, you know?
Yeah, that's true.
So
I don't know. It's just hard to imagine Sony letting Nintendo make some decisions the way they did. You know, considering Sony's stuff has been so, I'm not going to say it's like by the numbers, but they you know, they have a brand image, and Nintendo does too, and they definitely differ from each other's. It's just kind of a funny thing to imagine. Like, how different would everything be?
Well, the original plan was for them to partner up on a CD add-on for a home console. There was nothing in the plans about a handheld.
Sure.
So, yeah, if they had partnered for a handheld, then yes, it probably would be much different from the DS. But, you know, I don't see why Nintendo necessarily would go that route. Yeah, maybe it would have ended up with something much more traditional than the DS. But, you know, then again, you never know where Nintendo is concerned. Again, Sony is much more of a, you know, a partner in this scenario than a leader. They only became a leader because they didn't have, you know, that Nintendo alliance to help them out. And it ended up working great for them. But, you know, I don't know how much they'd be steering the ship.
Yeah. If I ever get my hands on a magic lamp and a genie, I am 100% going to just go be a fly on the wall of 2017 just to see what the alternate reality would look like.
Yeah, that'd be interesting to see how it turned out.
Maybe you work for Nintendo Sony Magazine.
PlayStation Power. Yeah, never know.
Wow.
Okay, well, let's move on to a what-if scenario that isn't quite as crazy and far-reaching. What if, back around the turn of the century, Nintendo had not sold Rare?
This is a good one, too. So, looking back at this one, you know, historically, I actually have to say Nintendo made the right call on this move.
Yeah, I think you're probably right.
I think that, in my opinion, Rare's quality of gaming went down after the release of, I don't know, Perfect Dark. I can't remember the exact time in which their quality kind of went down, but in general, Rare just hasn't been the same company. I don't know if that's a byproduct.
Oh, no, you're absolutely right. I think Nintendo saw the writing on the wall. I think they noticed that their output had slowed down, and I don't want to say the quality had decreased necessarily, but they certainly were not the same company that they were throughout the bulk of the N64 era. So, you know, Nintendo did not really do, you know, a bad thing by selling Rare off.
No, I don't think so either.
However, if Nintendo hadn't sold Rare, I do think there are a few key things that would have played out differently. For example, I think we would have gotten a third console Banjo-Kazooie game much sooner. And it probably would have turned out a lot better than it did on Microsoft's system. I think we probably would have gotten another 3D Donkey Kong platformer instead of DK going on a long hiatus like it did. And we probably would have gotten some rare titles on GameCube and Wii that were, you know, first-person shooters and probably would have been, you know, just as beloved as their previous offerings, Perfect Dark and GoldenEye. Plus, we could finally have Banjo and Conker in Smash Brothers.
Yeah, totally.
But the biggest difference would probably be that Nintendo fans would still be able to play classic games on current Nintendo hardware. We'd actually get virtual console releases of Banjo, and they'd probably figure out some deal with GoldenEye, and we'd probably get Jet Force Gemini, and we'd still have Battletoads and Wizards and Warriors on Nintendo systems where they belong, instead of them having to be locked away on Xbox or, you know, sort of erased from gaming history.
Yeah, I think you're right, and I wonder how many versions of GoldenEye we'd be playing by now.
probably just one or two. I feel like the licensing with the James Bond folks would still have kept that away most of the time, but I do think they would have figured something out to give it to us on Virtual Console. But yeah, I think it's when it comes to those classic games that's had the biggest effect on Nintendo's breakup with Rare. All right, well, moving on from there to some scenario that was a lot more recent.
Mm-hmm.
What if Nintendo had, you know, taken all the naysayers' advice a few years ago during the rough Wii U years and ended up going software only?
Man, this is an easy one, but I want to hear your opinions, Chris.
Well, I think at the outset, you know, many fanboys would have cheered. Many gamers would have been, yes, you know, especially Microsoft and Sony fans, you know. They'd be like, yeah, we can finally get awesome games we couldn't play before, like The Legend of Zelda and Mario. And, of course, investors would love it, and the stock prices would probably, you know, go way up. For a time, anyway.
Right.
You know, I imagine that, you know, after that initial high, things would start, you know, go in the other direction. You know, that excitement would go away. It would be a very sad time for Nintendo. I mean, without the need to sell hardware, they'd probably lose a lot of good people. They'd probably really cut back their focus a lot. And they'd probably just concentrate on a few core brands.
Yep.
You know, obviously we'd still have Mario. We'd still have The Legend of Zelda. You know, I imagine they'd try to keep Kirby around because they loved Kirby. You know, but there'd still be Pokemon, although, you know, Pokemon, I think, you know, technically could have existed as its own separate entity. So,
sure.
You know, maybe they'd all just be published, you know, under the Pokemon company, under the non-Nintendo umbrella, and they'd be off, you know, doing their own third-party thing separately. Who knows?
Yeah, maybe Pokemon would go on releasing consoles or something.
Probably not. You know, back at that time, you know, Metroid was kind of a dead brand. I don't think that Nintendo would be like, yeah, we've gone software only. Let's bring back Metroid. I don't think we'd be getting any more Metroid games. You know, Fire Emblem, maybe not, would still be around.
Yep.
You know, Smash Brothers, you know, that's probably big enough to still exist. Or maybe Mario would just be like the guest character in, you know, PlayStation All-Stars, right, or whatever it was called.
Right. Yeah, that's weird to think about.
So, you know, I think that's, you know, how it would go. But for the most part, they would kind of end up like Sega a bit, where, you know, despite, you know, having this great, robust library when they're a first-party creator with their own hardware,
yep,
it just might not translate that well into third-party land.
Yeah, it's funny. It is a double-edged sword. It's so easy to look at it and say, oh, yeah, Nintendo on third-party, that's great. You know, access to, you know, the tools and being able to have, you know, these amazing-looking games.
Yeah, they have all the cutting-edge hardware that, you know, they don't necessarily invest in on their own.
Right, but that's not everything, you know? And
Nintendo's proven that time and time again.
And I do think that, you know, Sega is a perfect example to look towards. I mean, now, Nintendo might make better sound business decisions than Sega. I mean, I think that could be argued.
Yes,
but at the same time, I think that there is a case to be made about, you know, if you look at that story and you see how that worked out for Sega, it really hasn't panned out as well as it probably should have or could have.
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, Sega seemed like they were on their last legs a few years ago.
Yeah.
And it was only by, you know, finally teaming up with Atlus that they were able to, you know, keep themselves from going down.
Yeah, and that's really unfortunate. And it makes you wonder if Nintendo could have the same misfortune, you know. There are games, I mean, if you look at, you know, almost everything Nintendo releases, there's some tie to the hardware, and there's some, you know, reason why they're making a game. I mean, even with Switch, there's a lot of titles where you can tell that, you know, it's like ARMS was specifically designed for the hardware.
Right.
Yes, Splatoon, specifically designed for the hardware.
Mm-hmm.
There's just a lot of creativity that comes from the actual hardware manufacturing process.
Yes.
And Nintendo doesn't really allow us to see behind the curtain that much to see how that all, you know, shakes down. But I assure you that that is a huge part of their game creation process. And you wonder how much that would be affected by that going away. I mean, I guess one good example is you look at the mobile games they've released. And you could argue that those are a look at what that might look like.
Yeah, somewhat.
You know, and in some ways, the magic is not quite there the way it is on a normal Nintendo console. So, I don't know. It's an interesting case.
Yeah, I mean, I think looking at the mobile games does give you a really good idea, and that is, you know, they're very solid games. We've got some, you know, pretty decent stuff here, but it really doesn't have the innovative Nintendo magic that they're most known for. I mean, like you were saying, that hardware-software synergy is really important and is a huge driving factor in getting the super creative games that we get out of Nintendo.
Yeah, you know, and it does. It's I think Nintendo really, in a lot of ways, I kind of compare them to Apple,
mm-hmm.
in the sense that the part of what makes it special is that they own the entire experience, right? They own,
yeah, totally.
They own the hardware, they own the software, and you can only get it on that particular piece of hardware. And mm-hmm. if Apple started putting, you know, their iOS on different devices, and they weren't really sure how you were experiencing it. Maybe some didn't have a touch screen. I mean, no, that's crazy. But some didn't have some of the features. Some were, you know, they weren't in control of all that aspect. Then you start to lose some of the magic. You start to lose some of the fact that they get to own the experience from start to finish. And I think that really is part of what makes Nintendo so special.
Yeah, I'm not sure I would, you know, totally go that far. You know, it's a game console, so you know, they're very well aware of the capabilities. I'm sure they could make some spectacular stuff. But yes, I do feel like, you know, being able to, you know, sculpt hardware that perfectly matches their needs is a big driver when it comes to their creativity. So I do feel like that would go down. I mean, yeah, I do feel like that's what the ultimate outcome would be, is that the whole video game industry would just end up stagnating a bit. The innovation that Nintendo brings to the table, you know, would kind of just dry up. I mean, take a look at what else is out there right now aside from Switch. We have the PlayStation 4 and the Xbox One X One, or whatever the heck it's called. And they kind of seem like the same system with only a few different exclusives each to differentiate themselves.
Yeah.
And Nintendo is the one who comes in and shakes things up with stuff like motion control on Wii, or with, you know, the console handheld hybrid on Switch. And, you know, probably another thing, if Nintendo went software only, is that there just would be no more dedicated handheld games. We'd only be getting smartphone titles, but, you know, we wouldn't have Switch, we wouldn't have 3DS. That would probably just be the end for, you know, core gaming on the go.
Yeah, which is pretty crazy.
And so, you know, it's not like the industry would, you know, shrivel up and die off, but it would be a lot less exciting than before, is what I think the ultimate outcome would be.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I think that Nintendo has really pushed a lot of envelopes and really kind of changed the way hardware manufacturers have to make things and think about things.
Mm-hmm. Now, they've been doing that since the beginning, it seems.
And if you know, I remember Nintendo in Redmond, they used to have a little museum that kind of showcased each console hardware cycle.
As they do now at Nintendo New York?
Yeah, and if you wanted to know, you know, what the next gen consoles were going to look like controller wise, you could almost always look at the last generation Nintendo controller. And I know that might ruffle some feathers by saying that, but in a lot of ways it's true, right? The analog stick on the N64 kind of showed up on the next gen for everything. Same with the Rumble Pack, right? Everything started to incorporate Rumble after that. GameCube, they released a WaveBird, and that was all wireless controllers, and there was almost no suffering of any gameplay, right? You could play this controller, and it was completely wireless. And then the next gen, everybody's controller was completely wireless. Nintendo has done a lot of things for the industry, almost subliminal ways, really. So now with the Switch, it almost makes you wonder, what are they going to do next? Like, how is this going to influence the other console manufacturers, if at all? I mean, I hope it will.
It's a good question.
But I do think that this will make some sort of impact on the industry in general.
Yeah, it almost seems unavoidable because it happens every single time.
Yeah, so we'll see. I mean, more than anything, the fact that you can now play games wherever you want is a pretty cool innovation, even if graphics take somewhat of a backseat. I think it's even less noticeable this generation than ever before. So the next gen makes you think that it'll even be less of a noticeable difference. So
yeah, I think that's very, very true. I have to say, though, you know, if Nintendo, you know, did end up, you know, getting out of the hardware business, I don't think they would do it 100%. You know, I think that Nintendo still probably would have gone along with their plans to release an NES and a Super NES Classic, mm-hmm. and, you know, still snuck out some hardware that way. And I think they would still consider, like, making their own wacky peripherals that were specific to a few particular games, and they would come out, you know, on PlayStation, but it would come with some extra peripheral that you have to use to play the game. They would still get some of their crazy ideas out that way, but for the most part, it would just be a shadow of what it was before. But, yeah. You know, who knows? I could see, you know, in this alternate reality where Nintendo has gone, you know, pretty much software only, that they could still end up being like, you know what? We're just going to release, you know, this new game on PlayStation. It's called Nintendo Labo, and there's this little device, and you have to plug in some cardboard, and it would still work the same way, but, you know, it would probably cost, like, you know, $150, because I have to include the tech, you know, with every copy they sold. But I could still see them trying to do something like that.
Yeah, that's true. I could see that as well. But I don't really want to think about that too much. I prefer them sticking around where they are.
Yeah, absolutely. Me too. And judging by how things are going with the Switch, you know, that seems like the course we're going to follow for a while.
Sweet.
Hopefully for a long, long time.
Hopefully.
All right. And with that, I think that brings this week's big topic to a close.
Wow. We did it.
Hey, yeah. We actually agree on most things, too.
Amazing.
Yeah. Hopefully it was fun for the listeners as well. And I guess with that in the bag, it is time to close up this week's show. But
first,
before we go, I believe we have time for one more thing, and that is a dramatic reading.
What do you have on the docket for this week, Chris?
This time, it comes from the pages of Nintendo Power Magazine, Volume 2. It is a news article from the NES Journal section called Introducing the Power Set. Nintendo has announced the introduction of an all-new version of the NES, appropriately named the Power Set. This powerful combo includes the Power Pad, Control Deck, two controllers, the Zapper, plus three games on one triple play game pack, Duck Hunt, Super Mario Brothers, and World Class Track Meet. This system will start showing up on store shelves in September. The Power Pad offers players a whole new way to enjoy video games, with their feet. Instead of using a controller or joystick, select games can be controlled by operating the 12 color-coded keys on the pad itself. It's a great way to avoid becoming a couch potato. To start with, three games will be available for Power Pad play. World Class Track Meet, included in set, lets you compete in several different sports events. Dance Aerobics takes you through several routines, plus has some offbeat options like pad antics. And Super Team Games, where up to six players can join in at one time on selections like the Relay Race and Tug of War. If you know anyone who is planning on getting an NES in the near future, tell them to check it out.
I mean, back then I probably knew a billion people almost about to get an NES.
Yeah, but probably not too many who wanted to get a Power Pad. It's kind of funny that that's the way they introduced the Power Pad to the world.
Yeah, that really is.
It was very awkward, and they're just like, hey, there's a Power Pad included. Like, what the heck is that? But, I mean, I guess they kind of explain it, but very, very strangely. I have to say, you know, reading that, oh, a new way to play games with your feet, huh?
Yeah.
That does not exactly make you want to get out of my chair. and rush to the store to buy this thing.
I love that line where it's like, now you get to experience them with your feet.
Yeah, exactly.
So good. Do you like Power Pros podcasts? Well, now you get to experience them with your feet.
If you say so. Anyway, that does it for this week. Pete, do you want to do the sign-off?
I don't know. It feels weird.
Come on. Give it a try.
Well, that's it for this week. As always, you can find us at powerpros.podbean.com. You can follow us at Power Pros Prod on both Facebook and Twitter. You can follow me, the Pete, on Twitter at Burly Red Yeti. And you can find Chris at Chris the Huff.
Furthermore, you can email us at powerprospod@gmail.com. And of course, if you like the podcast, it would be great if you told your friends about us.
Yes, please tell your friend.
Thanks for listening, everybody. For myself, Pete Michaud,
sayonara,
and my former Mad Gear boss, Belgar, we will see you next time. Is everything okay on your end? What the hell?
Yeah, everything's good.